Mr. Charles H. Percy, president of Bell & Howell and chairman of the Republican Committee on Program and Progress, will face the Fourth Estate shortly, and Monitor joins Meet the Press. Right now, some getting ready type music, Richard Maltby and Rose Room. Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this unrehearsed news conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. The presidential campaign of 1960 is off to a flying start. Our guest today is Mr. Charles H. Percy, the chairman of a special committee which has just completed the drafting of a long-range program for the Republican Party. The final installment was made public a few days ago. It deals with methods for strengthening our economic system to resist the challenge of world communism. Mr. Percy's committee was composed of some 40 experts in many fields: foreign policy, finance, science, agriculture, labor, human rights. The Republican National Chairman, Senator Thurston Moorton, last night challenged the Democrats to a nationwide series of debates on the committee's 16-year program. Mr. Percy has been called the idea man of the Republican Party. He rose to prominence as an organizer and a fundraiser. In private life, he is the president of the Bell & Howell Company of Chicago. He assumed that position 11 years ago at the age of 29. Now seated around the press table, ready to interview Mr. Percy, are Jack Bell of the Associated Press, Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune, John Steele of Time & Life magazines, and Ray Shearer of NBC News. Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the panel, will be back with us next week. Now, Mr. Percy, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Bell.
Mr. Percy, your reports lay a great deal of stress on budget balancing. And yet your number one report says we have no choice but to maintain superior military strength over Russia. A two-part question. Do we have superior military strength over Russia now, and can we maintain it with a balanced budget?
The testimony that we received, Mr. Bell, indicated that there are certain areas, of course, such as in submarine warfare and in ICBMs right now, where there is a superiority of the Russians over American defenses. But on balance, considering the defense of the country is a balanced whole, we still maintain a margin of superiority over the Russians. Whether or not this can be done with a balanced budget in the future is difficult to say. We're anticipating that with the increase in gross national product, that we can do this with a balanced budget and should set this up as an objective.
Which is the more important, balanced budget or military superiority?
There's no question, and we've made it eminently clear in our report, that the needs of the country, and particularly our military needs and strategy, must be placed ahead of balancing the budget. Our attempt should be to do it within the budget, however.
Your national security report says the people are entitled, and I quote, to frank disclosure of our relative strengths and weaknesses and military capabilities. Are we getting that today?
I think there's always a tendency in governmental departments to perhaps not say as much as the public would like them to say. I would tend to say under this administration that there's been more frank disclosure of our position than ever before. We simply reiterate as a matter of principle that government should lean in the direction of educating and informing the American public as much as possible, because in our democratic process, it's necessary that we have these facts to evaluate the kind of a sacrifice that must be made if the present level of taxation or whatever it may be is inadequate.
Well, yet in your reports, and I read them all, I didn't find any discussion of the missile gap or why we were behind Russia on missiles or anything of that sort. Isn't that as important as some of the other things you discussed?
Yes, it is. We decided to try and look ahead rather than look back. You'll notice in the report there are no recriminations against past administrations for this missile gap. But, of course, it was the cancellation of a $75 million modest program in 1947 by the president at that time under the previous administration. that set us back because we didn't really begin our missile development until the first year of the Eisenhower administration.
Mr. Scherer,
In your speech to the Young Republican National Federation in Denver in June, you spoke rather forthrightly to this effect, that the Republican Party would not commence its regeneration until its members recognized that something was drastically wrong. You said that something drastic had to be done to make it right. Now, in reading these rather voluminous reports of your Program and Progress Committee, nowhere do I find that you recommend any drastic changes from current Republican policy.
There are some changes recommended. I think that my reference in that talk, the Young Republicans, was simply that we have failed to articulate some of the actions and performances of the administration. And I think the Vice President just the other day indicated that whereas the actions of this administration have been dynamic, we have failed to find dynamic means of expressing those actions and putting this across through our candidates.
Could you enumerate some of the changes from current policy that you mentioned a moment ago?
Yes. I think that we, in the area of reporting to the American people, leaned much more in the direction of, say, freeing up travel of journalists throughout the world. I frankly do not think we should get reports on an area as important to the American people as Red China through West Germany or from Canadian correspondents. I think the correspondents that we are used to following should be given access there, and I think that this should be vigorously pushed, and we discussed this at some considerable length in the committee. The policy is changing in the administration. I think the State Department is trying to free it up. We think it should be pushed more vigorously.
Well, granted that your report states noble aims, granted that you worked long and hard and you went through a lot of mental gymnastics, I'd like to ask the question that the practical politician would ask. What does it all add up to? How are you going to apply this? What will you do with it?
What we were hoping to do in this report, and what I hope we've accomplished, when we, at the outset of the committee's work, we decided that we would do something in stating principles in a program that would be good for the country, and that if we were stating these as in the national interest, in the long run, they would serve the interests of the Republican Party. But we were not charged with the responsibility of writing something that would just be good for the Republican Party. If Republican candidates will take this work that we have done as research material for speeches, for public debate, for town hall meetings, and if we will debate the big issues of the time in public, this is the American way of informing ourselves, and I think we'll strengthen our party as a result of it and attract better candidates.
Your reports have stirred up, I would say, remarkably little controversy. Doesn't this indicate to you that the tone of them has perhaps been a little bit too bland? Or is it too early for that, maybe, for controversy?
Well, the controversy is mounting. I think we would be disappointed if there were not controversy. But the very fact that the Democratic National Committee saw fit a week ago today on a Sunday to call a special press conference at their headquarters and bring a group of scientists there to condemn our report on science and technology is evidence of the fact that controversy is being raised. When Senator Humphrey in Ottawa, Canada, saw fit to condemn our committee, I think that at this point controversy is being aroused. Chairman Butler of the Democratic National Committee just issued a special press release. I believe they are paying some considerable attention to it, and this is in the national interest, I think, because perhaps they will start to do the same thing then and try to do a better job than we did.
Mr. Steele.
Mr. Percy, let's go into a little controversy in your own party, if you don't mind. Do you think that your reports will play a part in the 1960 elections?
We did not think so originally. We tried to look ahead 10, 15, 16 years. And the problem we tried to face is the fact that, generally speaking, people in political life and in government are so busy dealing with the immediately urgent that they haven't time to deal with the ultimately important. So that we were trying to look beyond 1960. But Chairman Morton has just issued a challenge to the Democratic Party to debate in town hall meetings, on radio or television, any phase of the program, and I think this will then force it into a 1960 issue.
Well, that being the case, Mr. Percy, who do you think best fits the mold of this philosophy that you set up in these reports? Is it Vice President Nixon or Governor Rockefeller of New York? Who could best articulate it?
We have consulted with both the Vice President and with Governor Rockefeller. Both of them have commented on the report and favorably. I don't think it fits the mold of any particular individual. And we were trying to drive at issues rather than personalities in this report.
Well, who best reflects this progressive dynamism, or what did you call it? You called it something like that the other day, dynamic progressivism. Who
dynamic
best reflects
conservatism.
It among the candidates?
I think both candidates do. I think both of them are dynamic. I think both of them are progressive. And I think that both of them will use this material as they see fit in the preparation of their own policy positions. I'd be disappointed if it were not helpful to them.
Well, Mr. Percy, now you've articulated this doctrine, and it's going to be debated. What about the possibility of you being a vice presidential candidate? You're well thought of in the Middle West. You're young. Seem to be pretty handsome. How about it?
No, I would not be.
Under no conditions would you be a national candidate?
No, because I would have to feel in my own heart that I would be the best person for that. And there would be so many people that I would place ahead of myself who have more experience and background that I, on that basis, would absolutely disqualify
myself. Are you going to run for the Senate next year in Illinois? You have a contest out there. And
no, I will not be. I will not be running.
Mr. Drummond.
Mr. Percy, when 40 Republican experts agree unanimously to a report like this, it leaves some of us with the impression that it must be either old stuff with new words or new stuff with vague words. Now, I'm rather surprised that this report did not evoke criticism within the party, either from the extreme right or from the Republican liberals in the Senate, like Javits or Case or others. How do you account for that?
We communicated with every Republican senator and congressman, every defeated Republican governor, senator, and congressman, asked them for advice and counsel. We have reflected many of their ideas in this report. By looking ahead 15 years, perhaps this helps us because it does take it out of the immediate emotional area.
Yes. Well, I'd like to raise another aspect of controversy within the party and put it to you frankly. Many people, I think, honestly feel that one reason that the government is not making greater headway in closing the gap in scientific weapons with Russia is the budget ceiling. And you've stated, and we've all read the report, that you definitely would not let the concept of a balanced budget stand in the head of achieving that. Would you then be frankly saying that at this point, this is a significant departure from administration policy?
There is no question but what the expenditure for military will increase in future years. What we have simply said is that we must cut down in some areas to emphasize other areas.
No, but haven't you said that you would put the priority objective of closing the missile gap ahead of the priority objective of balanced budget?
Absolutely.
And that does not seem to be, in the judgment of many, the policy of this administration.
If it isn't the policy of the administration, I do not understand the policy of the administration then. Our statement is perfectly clear. And we've had no charter from the president or the vice president or anyone else in the Republican Party that this report must conform to administration policy. They've given us an absolutely free hand. We say without equivocation, it would be indefensible for any of us to take a position that we should not quickly and urgently close this gap.
Mr. Bell.
We have another sizable gap, too, in space. Your report says that we're planning to transport a man to the moon by 1970, I believe. Yes, it was 1970. Don't you think we'll find a Russian colony already existing there if we wait till 1970?
We said certainly by 1970 this is possible. I think we'd all be very disappointed if this were not possible before that date.
Well, do you think the administration is doing enough in space activities at this point?
I think it's a question of how much we can actually absorb. Because of our late start, not until 1953, we've had to impose crash program on crash program. And just dollars alone will not do it. Our attitude in this report is that instead of having these programs on a feast and famine basis, every time another missile goes in the air from the USSR, a wave of enthusiasm goes for budget spending in that area, we should budget and plan well in advance. Regardless of what our opposition does, we should stick with these programs. And we should have fewer programs on a crash basis, because I think the end result will be better and the cost will be much less if we can orderly plan these things in advance.
Quick flight back from space. Let's get to the farm, which is going to be an issue in 1960, obviously. One of your reports says that the family farmer is the backbone of the economic, nation's economic system. Another report says that farming is coming to the point where automation will take over and large amounts of capital will be necessary. Where is a family farmer going to get the large amount of capital to run an automatic farm?
Mr. Bell, if I remember that sentence in the report out of 40,000 words correctly, we said the modern family farm is the backbone of our agricultural system. I do not think it's wise for us to attempt to subsidize marginal farming in any form of the federal government or otherwise. And I think if a family farm is not able to keep up with modern techniques, it would be much better for those people in that farm family who are earning probably 35 or 40 cents an hour on their labor to go into city life, urban life, where they're desperately needed now in the industrial community and where they can earn far more. I just don't think we should encourage people to stay on subsistence living farming that doesn't give them the kind of an income they should have. But I do feel that the modern efficient farm based on a family where a man is farming enough land to give him a good income is still the backbone of our American farm, and we check this very carefully with the president of the American Farm Bureau Association, past President Alan Klein.
Mr. Percy, the labor section of your report may have special significance in view of the steel strike now. Your report promises to protect what is described as the clear right of working people to join a union. Would you also protect the right of people who don't choose to belong to a union?
Yes, but I don't think it's necessary by legislation. I think you can do these things other than by legislating on them, and public education probably is as good a way to do it as any. If you're asking what my attitude is on the right to work laws, we didn't take any position in the committee on that.
I don't seem to find in your report any recommendation for dealing with strikes such as those we're having now in the steel industry. Does that mean that your committee is satisfied with the present machinery?
I would hope that the present machinery, the Taft-Hartley Act, would be adequate. If it's not adequate, then some other measures would be necessary. Unfortunately, Congress will be back in session a few days after the 80-day period would be up.
Mr. Shearer.
Mr. Percy, when Mr. Khrushchev was here barnstorming around, I heard him say at one point that he couldn't tell the difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Do you think your report would help him?
Yes, I think it would. I would hardly recommend he read report number 4 on economics, because here we draw a sharp distinction, and this has drawn sharp criticism from the Democratic Party.
Well, there are probably a lot of Americans who couldn't give you a very precise differentiation either. What would you say is the prime difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party?
We've tried in these reports, which would be available to anyone that would like them from the Republican National Committee, to draw the distinction in almost every area of our basic issues that we're facing today. If we boil it down to one sentence, and it's a little hard to boil anything, Shakespeare, the Bible, or this modest report, down to one statement, I would say the distinction probably is that our tendency is to solve problems as close to people as we possibly can. The tendency of the opposition party is generally to set up a bureau in Washington, some department down here, shift the problem to Washington away from the people. I don't think you solve problems that way. I think you merely move them someplace else and set them up on a bigger scale and increase the cost of solving them.
You come out, I notice, in your technology report for spending, what is it, $36 billion a year for scientific research in 1976, as against 10 that we're spending now. On the other hand, you stressed your fiscal solvency point. How do you square these two things? Isn't that an enormous expenditure?
Yes, it is a great increase, but if we look back 10 years, which we tried not to do too much in the report, but 10 years ago we were spending $2.5 billion, today $10 billion, and we think in 1976 $36 billion can be absorbed, but we're saying also that private industry and educational institutions must spend at least a half of this.
Mr. Steele.
Mr. Percy, it seemed to me that almost every recommendation in your reports were qualified with a but, seemingly to limit the role of the federal government. It was true on your recommendations on housing and education and social welfare. What is this fear and trembling about the growth of the federal government?
I don't think we have any fear or trembling about it. I think we've made a very clear-cut statement right in our preface that we believe that we should have strong, efficient central government. I think there's a misimpression that the Republicans are against central government. We're not. We think there must be a strong government to carry out our military policy, a strong government to carry out our foreign policy, which only can be carried out by the federal government. But on the other hand, we are concerned that you can keep adding and adding and adding to the federal government's functions so that you actually dissipate their energy and don't make it possible for them to concentrate on the things that only central government can accomplish.
Well, since the country and its wealth is growing, and you visualize that in your goals for 1974, why shouldn't the role of the federal government expand with it? Doesn't it almost have to?
I think it inevitably will. I am quite sure the post office would not be large enough for 175 million people to handle the 240 million people that will be here in 1976.
But then why, in most of these recommendations, perhaps not on the foreign front, but on the domestic front, was there this clause, this warning against federal government over-participation in the field, what you regarded as over-participation?
We simply feel that now the role of the central government must be one of concentrating on those things that cannot be done in the region, states, or local communities.
Well, isn't the government, both in the amount of money it spends and its personnel, about larger today than it ever was before in peacetime? And we have a Republican administration.
Yes, but it was reduced by 250,000 people in the first few years of the administration. But the country is a good deal larger now than it was 7 years ago, and a great deal more prosperous.
Realistically, isn't the federal government going to grow in its functions and in its spending and in the number of people it employs?
Oh, I think realistically it's inevitable that it will. What I do hope is that the percentage of the tax revenues taken by the federal government out of gross national product can gradually diminish through the years. And if it will, if we can have sufficient economic growth.
We hope so, too.
Mr. Drummond.
May I deal with another aspect of the same question, Mr. Percy? You have strongly advocated in the report higher pay for teachers, more public schools, better classrooms, more of them, and a real meeting of the educational needs. I'm sure the emphasis is on the side that the primary responsibility rests with the states. Now, what happens, in your judgment, if, after adequate experience, state government does not meet this problem? Do you then turn vigorously to meet it by the federal government?
I think the implication is very strong in our report that if the local communities and the states do not meet this responsibility, right. We've spelled out what the responsibility is.
I understand.
That it will have to be done by central government.
All right. Now,
but
I
think it would be a sad situation in this country if the people of our communities will not respond to this challenge.
We're not sure it's happening. I mean, we're not sure.
I have absolute faith that the communities of this nation will meet the national purpose.
Do you think they are meeting the school need today?
I think that the number of new schools being constructed, the debate going on in my own school district about teacher salaries and curriculum is evidence of it.
One other quick question, if I may, and that is, in view of the need of the country having a national understanding of what the national policy is of the Republican Party, would you recommend a conference of the federal officials of the Republican Party and state governors in order to find out whether there was an agreement within the party that the state leadership of the party is going to do what this report advocates that states do?
I think such a conference would be highly desirable. I think we all need a greater dedication to national purpose in the United States. We need the same sort of emphasis in winning the peace today as we have in winning all the wars we have in the past. We've always met the need when we understand the need. This is the purpose of our report.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Percy, why are you so reluctant to run for office?
I have felt up to this time, as a father of five children and with the responsibility given to me in my business, that I could serve my government best as a private citizen. I've undertaken every responsibility given to me by the administration that I could possibly discharge. And I feel that you need a lot of chiefs, but you also need a lot of Indians. And at this point, I prefer to be a private citizen where I can speak and say what I want without any concern for winning votes by doing it.
Gentlemen, I think at that point we'll have to wait for Mr. Percy to return to get his final answer on that. I'm sorry, but I must interrupt. Thank you very much, Mr. Percy, for being with us.
And Monitor's thanks to Charles H. Percy, President of Ellen Howell, and Chairman of the Republican Committee on Program and Progress, and the members of the panel for a stimulating and enlightening half-hour, Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence Spivak. Now this personal word, if I may. One of the great delights of travel is getting to know people in other parts of the world. Since we all cannot travel as much as we'd like, an organization has come into being to bring people closer through correspondence. The organization is Letters Abroad. It can help you find a pen pal in some far-off place, and once you've entered into correspondence with this pen pal, you'll feel not only that you are hearing it firsthand about another country and about other people, but also that you yourself are helping to communicate American ideals. Undoubtedly not directly in what you write, but indirectly by the spirit and character of what you write. These days, this transference and this communication between ourselves and other people is indeed very important.